This is June 1st, 2014, and today I'm going to look at a koan and an article related to the koan, a New York Times article. You know, the basic issues in koans are our issues, are contemporary. They're not just some old stories of another time. And the connection, I think, will be clear with this in this Teisho. The koan is from the Blue Cliff record. It's one of the two most famous collections of koans, and has 100 koans. This is number 29, and it's called Dai Zui's It Goes Along With Everything Else. And here's the koan. A monk asked Dai Zui, when the conflagration at the end of a kalpa sweeps through and the great cosmos is destroyed, I wonder, is this one destroyed or not? Dai Zui said, it will be destroyed. The monk said, will it be gone with everything else? Dai Zui said, it will be gone with everything else. A little bit about this Dai Zui. He's a Chinese master whose actual Chinese name was Dai Sui with an S, but then the Japanese version of it, the S became a Z, so almost the same. I'm consulting this great source of master's biographies called Zen's Chinese Heritage by Andy Ferguson. And Da Sui, his dates are 10th century, basically, 878 to 963. He's recorded to have experienced great enlightenment while still quite young. The fact that this note would be here suggests that how it sort of points to how rare it is to experience great enlightenment. Lesser breakthroughs, yes, but great enlightenment, and that he did so at a young age. This is quite rare. Some accounts describe him as a diligent student. I'm just skipping through for things that are a little more meaningful than some of the details in here. Later in his career, he dwelled for more than 10 years in a large hollow tree at the site of an old temple behind Mount Dasui. Many of these masters took their own names from the mountains where they lived, so he would have had a different name earlier and then took the name Dasui. And a few short dialogues here. Guishan asked Dasui, Guishan was another great Chinese master. Guishan would have been the teacher in this exchange. Guishan asked Dasui, you've been practicing here with me for some time. Why haven't you asked any questions? Dasui said, what would you have me ask? Guishan said, why don't you ask, what is Buddha? What is Buddha was a standard opener in these dialogues between between a monk and a teacher. The word Buddha, as most of you know, really has a very rich meaning, as only incidentally is it related to this man 2,500 years ago, Siddhartha Gautama, who came to be known as the Buddha. But what is Buddha really means, what is this Buddha nature? What is this mind of enlightenment? So why don't you ask, what is Buddha? Dasui abruptly covered Guishan's mouth with his hand. Guishan exclaimed, you've truly attained the marrow of the teaching. So if this Dasui had indeed come to great enlightenment when he was young, then he would already now be responding out of this enlightened nature. And to have him cover Guishan's mouth when Guishan suggests, why don't you ask what is Buddha? He covers his mouth with his hand. What is the significance of that? And then Guishan's approval. You've truly attained the marrow. Here's another one. When Dasui himself was the master, he asked a monk, where are you going? The monk said, I'm going to live alone on West Mountain. Dasui asked, if I call out to the top of East Mountain for you, will you come or not? The monk said, of course not. Dasui said, you haven't attained living alone yet. I'm going to live alone on West Mountain. If I call to the top of East Mountain, will you come? No. Then you haven't attained living alone. What is the real essential meaning of living alone? Alone, all one. Another one. A monk asks, when the great matter of life and death arrives, then what? Dasui said, if there's tea, drink tea. If there's food, eat food. The monk said, who receives this support? Dasui said, just pick up your bowl. This question, when the great matter of life and death arrives, can be taken as on our deathbed when we're about to die, or it can be taken as any moment of this continuous birth and death that we call living. What do we do? If there's tea, drink tea. If there's food, eat food. Just pick up your bowl. And then also included in this section in Zen's Chinese Heritage is the full story from which today's koan was drawn. At the end, after Dasui repeats, it will be gone with everything else. It says here, the monk refused to accept this answer. He later went to another master and related to him his conversation with Dasui. This other master lit incense and bowed to the figure of the Buddha, saying, the ancient Buddha of West River has appeared. In other words, great approval and admiration for Dasui's holding firm that it will be gone with everything else. And then the master said to the monk, you should go back there quickly and atone for your mistake. The monk went back to see Dasui, but Dasui had already died. The monk then went back to see the other master, but that master had also passed away. This sort of this epilogue to case, today's case that we read, is obviously connected to the wording of the case. So let's go back to the case. Let's use the Chinese name. There's no, it's so simple to pronounce. This is one of the rare ones. It's easy to pronounce. And rather than using the Japanese version, so let's say Da Sui. So a monk asked Da Sui, when the conflagration at the end of the kalpa sweeps through and the great cosmos is destroyed, I wonder, is this one destroyed or not? First, these references, the conflagration at the end of the kalpa. A kalpa is a word used in both Hinduism and Buddhism for an immensely long period of time, eons and eons and eons. There are really very colorful, concrete descriptions of what a kalpa is, something like a... if you had a container of sesame seeds that were in a cube that was 1 mile high, 1 mile wide, and 1 mile deep, and you took one sesame seed out of there every 10,000 years, a kalpa wouldn't pass until you'd gone through every single one of them in that immense container of sesame seeds. There are other versions of it. Here I'll read a more scholastic definition of kalpa from a book called The Encyclopedia of Eastern Philosophy and Religion. A kalpa is divided into four parts: the arising of a universe, the continuation of the arisen universe, the demise of that universe, and the continuation of chaos. In the period of the arising of a universe, individual worlds with their sentient beings are formed. In the second period, sun and moon come into being, the sexes are distinguished, and social life develops. In the phase of universal demise, that's the third phase, fire, water, and wind destroy everything, but the fourth. And then the fourth is the period of chaos or total annihilation. So one way to understand this annihilation, I think a very common image that we have when we try to imagine total annihilation is fire, a conflagration. But the point is that it's accepted as perfectly natural order of things that there's an arising, there is a certain shorter or longer period of existence, then there's a decline, and then there is disappearance. Probably none of us will be around to witness this, at least in this body, in these bodies that we have now. But really, this great description of world epochs really is mirrored in each one of us as individuals. Each one of us arises, we're born, we live for a period of time, then we reach, in our advanced years, we reach a period of decline, and then we disappear. This is the nature of things. Because it's the nature of things, why would it be any different for different for the world, what we call the world or the universe, than it is for any individual member of a species, humans or animals or anything else. It's the nature of things. Things pass. They arise and they pass. In April, on April 17th, the April 17th issue of the New York Times Sunday Magazine had an article in it called "It's the End of the World as We Know It, and He Feels Fine." And this is by Daniel Smith, and it's a quite a long article about a very well-known environmentalist, I suppose you could call him, by the name of Kingsnorth, Paul Kingsnorth. Quite a provocative article, because Kingsnorth, after decades of ardent environmental activism, came to the conclusion that it's too late. That climate change, global warming, however you want to call it, has advanced too far. We've let it advance too far. And now it's irreversible. We can't do anything about it. Let me read some from this article. It describes him a little bit. He's 41 years old. He's a Brit. He co-founded a project, I guess you could call it, called the Dark Mountain Project. It was founded in 2009. The article says, from the start, it has been difficult to pin down even for its members. If you ask a representative of the Sierra Club to describe his organization, he will say that it promotes responsible use of the Earth's resources. When you ask Kingsnorth about Dark Mountain, he speaks of mourning, grief, and despair. He says, "We are living through the age of ecocide, and like a long dazed widower, we are finally becoming sensible to the magnitude of our loss, which it is our duty to face." Kingsnorth arrived himself at this point about 6 years ago, after nearly two decades of devoted activism. He had just completed his second book, Real England, a travelogue about the homogenizing effects of global capitalism on English culture and character. For months, in writing this book, he had interviewed publicans, shopkeepers, and farmers fighting to maintain small traditional English institutions, fighting and losing. Everywhere Kingsnorth traveled, he saw the forces of development, conglomeration, and privatization flattening the country. Does that sound familiar? By the time he published his findings, he was in little mood to celebrate. At the same time, he felt his long-standing faith in environmental activism draining away. And then these are his words. "I had a lot of friends who were writing about climate change and doing a lot of good work on it. I was just listening and looking at the facts and thinking, wow, we are really screwed here. We are not going to stop this from happening." And then the author of this New York Times article presents the very compelling evidence to support Kingsnorth. Animal and plant species were dying out at a spectacular rate. Scientists were beginning to warn that human activity, that is, greenhouse gas emissions, urbanization, the global spread of invasive species, was driving the planet toward a mass extinction event, something that has occurred only 5 times since life emerged 3.5 billion years ago. Everything had gotten worse, Kings North said. You look at every trend that environmentalists like me have been trying to stop for 50 years, and every single thing had gotten worse. And I thought, I can't do this anymore. I can't sit here saying, yes, comrades, we must act. We need only one more push, and we'll save the world. I don't believe it. I don't believe it. So what do I do now? I'm going to present the other side of things in just a minute, but I think the epiphany that this Kings North came to, this position of grieving, is a valid one and perhaps a necessary one in order to really get to the bottom of this matter of climate change and all these other forces of decline. I think the difference perhaps is that the conclusion he reaches is not the one that we need to reach. But let me read some more to let him have his case laid out more. So when he got to this point, the first thing that Kings North did was draft a manifesto. It was called Uncivilization, and it was an intense, brooding document that vilified progress. There is a fall coming, he announced, after a quarter century of complacency in which we were invited to believe in bubbles that would never burst, prices that would never fall. Hubris has been introduced to Nemesis. And then the author writes that the initial print run of this document, Uncivilization, was small, 500 copies, but it caught the attention of some very influential, very wealthy people who had been working in environmental movements. It says, there were others who saw Kings North's new work as a betrayal. With waters rising, deserts spreading, and resource wars looming, how could his message be anything but reckless, even callous? He and his sympathizers were branded doomers, nihilists, and crazy collapsitarians. Kings North regards such charges with equanimity, countering that the only hope he has abandoned is false hope. The great value of Dark Mountain, he has claimed, is that it gives people license to do the same. Whenever I hear the word hope these days, I reach for my whiskey bottle, he told an interviewer in 2012. It seems to me to be such a futile thing. What does it mean? What are we hoping for? And why are we reduced to something so desperate? Surely we only hope when we are powerless. Now there's something very dharmic here, very, very profound in this statement, because ultimately, we don't need hope. What we need is complete awareness, moment by moment. Hope is a kind of a thought form. It's something extra, something superimposed on things as they are. When we are completely one with things as they are, and that means change as well, and that means the same cycle of arising and continuation and decline and disappearance. When we are completely moving along with that, then we don't technically, ultimately, we don't need to cling to hope, which is usually, I think, usually in the form of thoughts. But more about that, that position of just being fully engaged and aware moment by moment, just a little more later, but let me read more from the article. Just to go back to this whiskey bottle thing, that's revealing, isn't it? That that he would take to the bottle when he hears anything. That's a kind of, obviously, an escape of some kind. So my impression of this guy is that he has seen what is beyond doing. He's seen what is beyond changing things, effecting change. But he hasn't broken through to the next state, which is what means this non-doing. The Chinese have this word wu wei, which the best literal translation is non-doing, which doesn't mean just passivity or resignation. When he refers to reaching for his bottle of whiskey, I hear resignation. But it doesn't mean that. Wu Wei is a central concept, experience, if you will, in Zen, in Buddhism. It means where you're so in harmony with things that the doing is not, doesn't come out of a sense of agency, that I am going to change things. But it doesn't need to be. We don't have to carry on our activism, and I'm involved in our Sangha Climate Change Committee, we call Earth Vigil, and I'm going to continue to be. We don't have to be carrying around the notion of I'm going to do something or we're going to do something if we're just fully committed to living in harmony with the world. But let me read some more. King's North, I'm only reading about a quarter of this article. It's quite a long one. King's North has admitted to an ex-activist's cynicism about politics, as well as to a worrying ambivalence about whether he even wants civilization as it now operates to prevail. He insists that he isn't opposed to political action, mass or otherwise, and that his indignations about environmental decline and industrial capitalism are, if anything, stronger than ever. Still, much of his recent writing has been devoted to fulminating against how environmentalism, in its crisis phase, draws adherents. And then the article quotes a Naomi Klein, author and activist Naomi Klein, who has known Kingsworth for many years, says Dark Mountain, the Dark Mountain Project, has given people a forum in which to be honest about their sense of dread and loss. Faced with ecological collapse, faced with ecological collapse, which is not a foregone result, but obviously a possible one, there has to be a space in which we can grieve, Klein told me, and then we can actually change. Now we're getting into something I think that resonates more with those of us who can accommodate both sides of this, that yes, it's quite possible, as many scientists now say, that we've passed the point of no return, and that there is nothing we can do or to arrest this. And yet, here we are. We get up in the morning. How do we conduct ourselves without hope? Zen practice and certainly Buddhism as a whole is all about living in harmony with the Tao, the Dharma, the way. And if we were able to do that, to live fully in harmony with the Tao, then it is its own reward. It is its own fulfillment. And we don't have to trouble ourselves with what will happen in the future. We don't have to get involved in thoughts of time and eventualities and catastrophes. If everyone lived in harmony with the Tao, then probably we wouldn't have gotten into this mess. Well, woulda, coulda, shoulda, here we are. But that doesn't mean to resign ourselves and then go on squandering resources. Because not because of the effect of our squandering resources, because to do so is a violation of nature, our nature. To use very crude philosophical terms, we want to live in truth, in accordance with truth. And that means not wasting, not using more than our share. That's maybe what it all comes down to. There is a story from Japan that relates to the name of a Zen temple in Japan where some of us spent some time, called Sogenji. It's one of the few Japanese Zen temples that accepts Westerners for training. I spent about 3 months there, and long time ago, 1985. And Sogenji, the translation of Sogenji is one drop temple. Ji means temple or monastery, Sogen, one drop. And here is the how this originated, this name. One day, a certain Japanese Zen master, well, I better use a name just to keep things straight here. Let's say his name is Gisan. Japanese Zen master Gisan was about to take a bath in the very same bath which is still used today at Sogenji. The water became overheated and way too hot to get into. Gisan called his attendant and ordered him to go and get some cold water from the well by the back gate of Sogenji. From that well, his disciple brought the water in and to put in the bath. And after many trips back and forth carrying water, Gisan, the teacher, finally said it was enough, that the temperature was just right, and to stop bringing more water. Having been told this, the monk took the little bit of water left in the bottom of the bucket, threw it away nearby, and placed the bucket upside down. Seeing him do this, Gisan yelled, "You idiot! You just threw away that little bit of water on the ground and turned over that bucket." Gisan continued, "At the moment you did that, you were only thinking of that as just a little bit of water and were therefore carelessly throwing it away, weren't you? But why didn't you go just one step further, especially knowing that this is the time of the year when there's never enough rain? Why didn't you put it on the garden's trees or flowers? If you had put it on the tree, it would have become the very life of that tree. If you had put it on the flowers, it would have become the very life of the flowers and lived on. Why do you begrudge such a small effort as that?" And then finally he said, "In even one drop of water, no matter how tiny a drop, the water's great value doesn't change at all. If you can't understand this value of one single drop of water, no matter how hard you train, you'll never become someone who can give life to that training." This is this was a principle, this no wasting. It was a principle of Zen training for forever, and still is. And it's not about saving money, or we have the same emphasis that trainees here are reminded of, not to, when you're taking a shower, after you've gotten yourself wet, turn off the shower while you're soaping yourself. There's no need for the water to be pouring out of the shower head while you're not using it, and then turn it back on to rinse off. Same with washing your hands at a sink. You don't need to have that water flooding out of there while you're not using it. You're just soaping your hands, and then turn it back on to rinse them off. This has nothing to do with, you know, lowering one's water bill by, you know, 1 cent, but it's more an attitude of respect for the ultimate value. That's as he says it, no matter how tiny a drop, the water's great value doesn't change at all. Same with food. The kitchen knows this. When you've cleaned out a bowl, it needs to be washed, to clean it out well. Use one of those rubber scrapers and get everything off. Not because a little film is going to amount to much, but because it's everything. It's our own nature, and therefore we don't want to waste any. Throw it out unnecessarily. Now, all right, this can get really obsessive with some people who have a tendency for obsessiveness to go to great lengths to there's a point at which it doesn't make sense to spend too much time for a tiny bit of this or that, but it doesn't take that much effort just to turn off the water when you're showering or washing your hands. It doesn't take that much effort to grab a rubber bowl scraper and do the final cleaning so there isn't any residue there. And then another thing from King's North here. "What do you do," he asked, "when you accept that all of these changes are coming? Things that you value are going to be lost. Things that make you unhappy are going to happen. Things that you wanted to achieve, you can't achieve. But you still have to live with it. And there's still beauty. And there's still meaning. And there are still things you can do to make the world less bad." So he's struggling, and I admire that struggle. But I think he hasn't come to a place of balance. He's still handicapped somewhat by a feeling of disappointment, of despair, of disillusionment. If he could take another step, go beyond that, then it's not a matter of the world being destroyed someday. There's no someday. There's just this day, now. How do we live in harmony with this moment? And that can mean getting active in working toward a more sensible, more harmonious use of resources. The article, this long article, mentions his very difficult father. He's a driven, competitive man who scraped his way up from a working class background to become the head of a manufacturing firm. Kingsnorth's father was not without a love of the outdoors, but it was a striving, willful kind of love. He often took Kingsnorth on long, arduous hiking trips, forcing him to carry heavy packs and disappearing far up the trail to teach his son the virtues of independence and struggle. You know, people talk about the danger of psychologizing politics, but I reject that rejection of psychology, that we have to see Kingsnorth's. I think it's illuminating to understand Kingsnorth's arc of ardent activism and then now disappointment, disillusionment, in terms of his basic relationship to his father. That he's still working through that, I believe. Kingsnorth and his the co-founder of Dark Project. What's that?
Dark Mountain.
Thank you. Dark Mountain Project. They say that their manifesto for this, it wasn't revolutionary, but neither was it nihilistic. Each man draws a distinction between a problem, which can be solved, and a predicament, which must be endured. Uncivilization was firm in its conviction that climate change and other ecological crises are predicaments, and it called for a cadre of like-minded writers to challenge the stories which underpin our civilization, the myth of progress, the myth of human centrality, and the myth of separation from nature. And here we get into pure Buddhism and pure Zen. These are myths. This is part of our conditioning before we come to practice, and we have to identify them as just that, myths, notions that have been woven into us, and that we don't have to accept that there's another side. There's always another side to this. This definition of predicament made me think of koans. A problem can be solved, the predicament must be endured. Endured, it's not the best word, I think, working on a koan. It's becoming one with it. That's not enduring. It's staying with it and looking. Looking directly into it. What is this? Without the notion of changing anything. And in that oneness with the koan, with the predicament, comes the resolution. We don't have to come up with an answer, quote-unquote answer, to resolve a predicament. The predicament is no longer a predicament. And that's the resolution. The co-founder of this Dark Mountain project, his name is Hein, Dugald Hein, sounds also English, said, people think that abandoning belief in progress, abandoning the belief that if we try hard enough we can fix this mess, is a nihilistic position, Hein said. They think we're saying, screw it, nothing matters. But in fact, all we're saying is, let's not pretend we're not feeling despair. Let's sit with it for a while. Let's be honest with ourselves and with each other. And then as our eyes adjust to the darkness, what do we start to notice? Hein compared coming to terms with the scope of ecological loss to coming to terms with a terminal illness. The feeling is a feeling of despair to begin with, but within that space, other things begin to come through. And that brings it right back to each of us as an individual. Of course, this whole matter of the end of the kalpa, the end of life as we know it, is just an enlarged version of the end of our own life. Death, as it's commonly thought of. When we receive a diagnosis of terminal illness, there's no hope. What do? Well, we get up in the morning, we do what we need to do, without dwelling on the end. It's of course, this is easier said than done. I suppose no one should presume to talk about this without having gone through it, but of course, it's what else would you do? I wonder, is this one destroyed or not? This one, clearly the monk is not just referring to himself, but he's referring to this one true nature. Daizui said, it will be destroyed. This is very perplexing, isn't it? Our true nature itself will be destroyed? This is what makes it a koan. It's confounding. The monk said, will it be gone? He's just checking back. Hold it. Did I hear you right? It'll be gone with everything else? And Daizui, it will be gone with everything else. There's a counterpart to this koan, a verse in the Mumong Kan that says, or Mumong, great Zen master Mumong said, when the universe is annihilated, it remains indestructible. It remains indestructible. Who's right here? Is Mumong or is Dasui? Which one is right? Which side of the hand is right? The palm or the back? Dasui's repose and his saying, it will be destroyed, it'll be gone with everything else. You can be sure there was utter composure and serenity with that. Because he'd come to terms with the fact that everything is life and death. Every moment. there may be a human concern or grief, which is natural enough. We don't need to pretend that it wouldn't be a terrible thing in one sense. Looked at one way, it's a catastrophic, it's a terrible thing to think of this earth of ours and the whole biosphere being destroyed by us, by the way. But such is the nature of things. Arising, continuation, decline, and disappearance. And we can work with that all the time with our own mortality. And when we come to terms with that, then we come to terms with the transiency of all phenomena, including the earth or even the universe. All right, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.